Andrin, thanks very much. Thanks all. We're now moving into the Q&A session. With us for the session are Andrin and Renee, and additionally, we'll have the leadership team also available, Max, Peter, Michael, Fortmar, Phil, Richard, and also Justin. For ease of moderation, I kindly ask that all questions are addressed to Andrin and Renee first, and then they can bring in the team. To ask questions, for those who dial in by the phone, please press the star one to line up for questions. And for those of you who are joining through the webcast, please enter just the question into the chat, which I'm also monitoring, and I also received some first questions, so that works. We will try to answer as many questions as we can from as many participants. So for the start, please stick to one question and a follow-up question, and then we can obviously go into to a second round. For that, I'll ask Nadia to start bringing up the Q&A roster on the phone. And while we do that, to be ready, I will receive a first question from the chat, Andrin, which goes to you. How do you see the cadence for further growth in the pharma partnerships? First question to you.
Thank you, Leonard. Well, undoubtedly, I mean, as we had said in the past, our pharma business took a significant hit during the pandemic while the company had been focusing its resources and attention to respond to COVID, and with, I think, an unprecedented response to provide very early high-quality PCR testing. That said, I think since the end of last year, we have clearly put our focus back on the core business, and I'm pretty encouraged by the progress we have made since and the number of deals that we were able to sign in the recent month, like the one with Alecto, for example. And I believe based on that, we will see the business back to attractive growth rates in the second half of the year. I also am encouraged by the progress that we're making on our tools that we use for our pharma partnership, as have been highlighted by the teams. And I think with that, I believe next to the service deals that we do, we will see more deals emerging where we can expect a certain value share. And I expect that in 2022, we will really see the first of those to materialize as well. And obviously on that, we will build and we will accelerate.
All right, thank you. And I think we're ready also with the phone lines. Nadia, over to you.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Puneet Souda from SVB Leerink. Puneet, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Okay, great. Thanks for the question. And Andrin and team, thanks for the excellent overview here. And Renee, great to have you on board. And thanks for those assurances on operational and reporting timelines. So look forward to that. My first question, Andrin, is you're outlining 1 million patients in the database, six disease model in the next 2 years, 10 by 2023-24. That appears to be significant growth versus what you have done before. So maybe if you could elaborate first, what are some of those indications beyond sort of metabolic and neurology where you would like to expand in the sort of immediate term? And then more importantly, are the investments already in place? Is the infrastructure, the center cards and getting those, those patient samples in and processing and putting that infrastructure, having the infrastructure to feed that into the database, are those already in or is that an investment that you need to do in the near term to sort of build that out? And then I have a few follow-ups.
Yeah, thank you, Puneet. So for the last part of your question, I think the infrastructure is by and large in place. Obviously, storing a little bit more data has some incremental storage costs, but we do not expect dramatic investments for reaching the 1 million samples in our biodata bank. There is an acceleration of the sample collection. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's our aspiration. And historically, we were able to grow the annual sample collection volume year over year, and we expect that to accelerate going forward. And so in the next 2 to 3 years, we are confident that we can hit the million number that we have set ourselves to. And obviously, while our diagnostic and our pharma business accelerates and its growth accelerates, that alone will accelerate the sample collection. That said, we also plan to be at one level more proactive and in certain areas where we have an opportunity to complement the data, to reach out proactively to the right institutions to complement the data that come in through our businesses. With regards to the insights that we generate or the priorities that we generate with the data, we have outlined to you that neuroscience and metabolomic, I think, is the core with regards of where we think we have the strength, where we have the network. So that's where we will prioritize. We also believe it's an area where you can see biotech and pharmaceutical companies rapidly increasing their R&D investments. So we believe that the, you know, those data sets and insights we generate will be very welcome by an ever higher number of institutions, potential partners out there who have an interest in those data. That said, we will also remain open. I mean, our data is broader than just that, and we do have companies increasingly who contact that move into specific rare diseases, and where we do have data or insights available, of course, we respond to those requests, even if it's not in those core areas that I have just described.
Okay, that's great. And then Andrin and Renee, and I know Renee is just a few weeks into the job, but I wanted to understand in terms of core growth. Obviously, you have a lot of growth here in COVID revenues in the near term, and hopefully that has generated meaningful cash. But what does that mean in terms of what do these efforts mean in terms of core growth? I was wondering if you can provide some view as to what that core growth or the long-term CAGR could potentially look like here, and just then a few follow-up for Michael and Justin.
Well, I'm happy to hand over to Renee after, but just, you know, two thoughts at the starting point, which is that for the core business, our intent definitely is go back to growth rates that we have seen prior to the pandemic. I mean, that's clearly our aspiration, and we have the confidence that, you know, we will get there. Now, this year, we are still in the process of getting back on track. I mean, our diagnostic business, we feel is already back to these growth rates, while our pharma business, as described, takes a little bit longer to adjust. When you sign a deal, first of all, you know, it takes a certain time, of course, to set it up. When you sign it, then it still has a certain lag until finally the revenues start to kick in, because we don't book revenues at the time that the deal is signed. But in the second half of the year, we believe that business will be back on previous growth rates as well. A last point to make, however, is that I don't think you should measure our success and our value creation opportunity just by looking at those short-term growth rates. We are convinced, and we try to outline in our presentation, that we believe that while the tools that we develop increase in insights and value, that we will be able to sign more deals where we really have long-term value share as part of the contracts, where if these projects then might be small to start with, but while they move through the R&D continuum, they will provide us with milestones and royalty upsides that will materialize then in the years to come. And I think our intention is not just to grow rapidly our pharma business short term, but to make sure that we are setting up the right tools and insights to sign these partnerships and have an increasing number of those in the years to come. So please keep that in mind when you think about how to value our pharma business.
Okay, that's excellent. And my last question is, and Andrin, you can direct me accordingly on that question. In terms of the pharma business, Michael and Justin both pointed out, obviously, excellent opportunities, very large market opportunity. Could you maybe elaborate as to what sort of that opportunity that you can, you know, capture here meaningfully in the near term? And what my, I think the question there is, you know, given what we have seen in past from Centogene, has under your leadership, I'm sure things are transforming. But what are some of the things that are changing on the, you know, pharma business development end specifically that could potentially drive more meaningful adoption among the pharma customer base and pharma partner base? And then lastly, just in terms of the level of demand that the business development teams are seeing from pharma, biopharma customers, after COVID, it's our view that a number of these companies have raised significant amount of capital, both large and small, and they are now looking at more and more opportunities. So wanted to get a sense of the level of demand, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Just one thought from my side, I'm happy to hand over to Justin and Michael. The pharma business, if you wish, and I want to emphasize that again, you know, took really a big hit during the pandemic. I mean, basically, most of our commercial efforts, if any, had been focused on COVID. And I think in that regard, you know, Justin, to be frank, was almost our one-man show, if you wish, out there, you know, going out and securing some of the deals that we're signing now. The company in general, I would say, has been historically very scientific driven for good reasons. I mean, we're reaping some of those benefits, but when we looked on where we are today and potential that we think we have in the future, we clearly have decided and are starting investing to building up our commercial presence as well. And Michael has joined us for that reason. I mean, he has just been here for a couple of weeks, but I have little doubt that under his leadership, you know, the team with Justin will be further expanded. And I think through that, we will be able to capture more of the potential that is out there. Now, with regards of what we see and what the demand is, Michael and Justin, maybe you want to say a few words?
Yes, this is Michael speaking, and thanks for that excellent question. And I can echo that obviously during the pandemic, you know, clinical development efforts have gone down significantly in the entire industry, and that's the reason why we were hit. But we see that exactly as you described, that picking up again, and actually more and more companies getting financed and ramping up activities through their clinical efforts into the clinic. And that's exactly where we come into play on the one hand side in one part of our business. But as also, you know, Phil and more specifically Peter pointed out, you know, given our internal efforts, we are in a good position, you know, to engage in discussions with large pharma partners in terms of target discovery, target validation efforts, and ultimately leading to drug discovery collaborations focused on certain diseases. And I think that's where we see the higher part of the value creation, and that's where we already see a demand right now. But as you would expect, you know, knowing that business quite well, those discussions will take time, and ultimately leading to, you know, thorough R&D collaborations, which are more long term, but also will provide us with an upside more longer term. And we see the demand for that. We're entertaining that discussions. But as Andrin said, we would expect in 2022, you know, that they would come to fruition.
Justin, anything to add?
Just as a, you know, as a representative of the company who's been with the company for almost 4 years now, you know, seeing an evolution in the way that we capture this data and position the data in front of pharma has really created, you know, a tremendous demand. And so I would say the tools that are being developed that we introduced today are critical to the success of our pharma services and the way that we partner with pharma. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Justin. And I think the, you know, what we do see is an uptake, and we tried to show that in the presentation as well, of investments into technologies that are particularly suited as rare disease platforms. And the recent, if you wish, validation of RNA, for example, as a platform, and that alone already, I expect, will make a difference going forward. I mean, there are a lot of RNA companies out there who do know that, you know, vaccinations with RNA is a great thing, but RNA also would lend itself to really address quite a long range of rare diseases potentially. So already there we see discussions that probably we wouldn't have had a year ago to that level. So there is a lot of demand out there. I think we have some low-hanging fruits with regards to offering access to our database. If you want to do a clinical trial in a rare disease and even a phase 1-2 and you need 10 to 15 patients, we already have those, and we already have those even fully profiled in many cases, and that obviously is a quick win and an easy way to accelerate a clinical program. But as Michael pointed out, I mean, in parallel, we're developing our fully integrated disease models that, of course, would allow us to really more strategically partner to capture, you know, some of the orphan drug acceleration opportunities. So short term, we maximize our services while investing into the long term strategic partnerships.
Great. Excellent. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sung Ji Nam from BTIG. Sung, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking the questions. Thank you so much for the very informative presentations today. Maybe just kicking off with, in terms of for your pharma partnerships and that the revenue potential over the next 5 to 10 years, you obviously kind of pointed out the potential royalty opportunities in terms of, you know, based on the market penetration. Do you anticipate the majority of your revenues in the longer term to come from these royalty payments?
I would think an increasing part of it, whether that's royalty or milestones or some form of value share, you know, the different tools by which you can make that happen. You could, of course, potentially also exit the program and, you know, get a payout in a one strategic transaction with a certain project. But overall, yes, I think we expect mid to long term that the large majority of the value that we generate will come from the value share that we get for having enabled these orphan drug projects. Once they move into the clinic, we think they will translate into milestones. The drugs, of course, that would reach the market, we expect them to translate into royalties.
Great. And then the two to four strategic partnership deals that you're anticipating over the next, you know, few years, should we expect these to come from your existing partnerships, just given the progress and the development process, or could they be also new partnerships that you could be signing in the future?
Half, I would say. We clearly work with Evotec, but also with Pfizer. And a few that I wouldn't want to name right now on existing projects where we are, you know, exploring what we have been discussing, and we expect some of them will materialize in something that will become more strategic and we can communicate. But at the same time, I would expect that we will also engage, especially now with Michael, you know, on board and the team that he's building with companies that we haven't worked with yet, and to make progress on that front as well. I mean, take the 2 to 4 as a good target for us that we will be confident that we will get there. Now, of course, as with, you know, those deals, I mean, the more our tools are validated, the more that we show that we can do those deals, of course, the more we expect the discussions to accelerate and also the number of deals to accelerate.
Great. If I could squeeze in one more question. Just kind of curious in terms of, obviously, one of the differentiating factors about Centogene is your multi-omic approach. You know, a lot of these rare diseases are monogenic, right? I mean, obviously, those are maybe some of the lower hanging fruit. But, you know, as far as on the genomic side, how much genomic insight do you think is currently not tapped into, if you will? You know, it's a function of not understanding the genomics, or do you think the genomic component of a lot of, you know, all these rare diseases that you're investigating are pretty well understood, and the remaining kind of the uncharted territory is coming from the other omics?
I would just say one word of introduction, and I'm happy to hand over to Peter. I mean, first of all, we have a wide range of rare diseases where we understand, you know, a genetic cause, if you wish, a gene at cause of that disease, but there are almost no treatments at all. So the fact that you understand the gene doesn't mean that you know how to approach those diseases from a discovery drug target point of view. And I think with our tools, even if the genomic context is well understood, with our omics tools, we can really enable discovering drug development. A simple example is that if you have a potential approach to a rare disease, but you know that when you try to move into the clinic, it would take you 5 to 10 years to monitor whether your drug would potentially make an impact on the disease. I mean, nobody can do that, especially not on a rare disease, which of course has a more limited commercial potential. If you're able with our omics work and our biomarkers to come up with a validated way by which you can have a clinical proof of concept within a couple of months, that of course opens up a huge door for, you know, R&D work in areas where the genetic context is well understood. With regards on, is the genetic context enough, or what else do you need to know to really understand the disease? Peter, maybe you want to say a few words.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. I think great question, because of course, genetics is the discipline where we have a very clear readout, which is not doubtable, but those genes are called ABC1 or C9orf72, and we don't sometimes don't know anything about the function. So without the omics disciplines we can do with the same biomaterials, we wouldn't have the tools to look into pathophysiology, understanding disease, defining the mechanism to lead to severe or mild disease, and so give the colors to the picture that is then the expression of a gene, and by that as well the severity of a disease. And in the end, by studying that in our patients, in our repository, we will learn as well how we can modify things and think about how to turn a severe case into a mild one. And in principle, that's what we do in the center of our biodatabase and the research generating insights.
And you know, Peter, I still remember that one example, I think that you shared with me, where you can have a rare disease and you basically have you find, let's say, a child with that mutation and that has a, you know, a severe disease progression. And you can go to somewhere else in the world, sometimes a different ethnicity, and you would find the same mutation and the child would be healthy. And I think next to, you know, the omics tools that will help us to understand it, this is also a reason why we believe the geographic spread and the diverse ethnicities that our biodatabank is covering gives us incremental insights to try to understand and probe some of those differences. And through that, of course, try to learn, you know, what makes the healthy outcome happen, and then use those learning to apply them to the ones who are not that fortunate.
Yeah, true. So this was the case of the spinal muscular atrophy, which has come to much attention now with gene therapy, where we learned as well that few children just survive without any symptoms. Although the geneticist would say this is an affected child because the mutation is clearly there. And so these exceptions from the rules, they are really driving our knowledge about the diseases and as well give us a leverage for mechanisms that we can explore and exploit for therapy.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Catherine Schulte from Baird. Catherine, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, Andrew and team. Thanks so much for hosting today and taking our questions. I guess first, you've talked about, you know, your broad geographic reach and the diverse composition of your biodata bank. Are there certain geographies where you feel you need to increase your penetration and data bank presence in order to increase your value prop to potential pharma partners?
Well, thanks for the question. The key, of course, elephant in the room, if you wish, is the U.S. We know the U.S. is, from a commercial point of view, by far the largest healthcare and life science market in the world. In relative terms, our presence in the U.S. is relatively small. For the value of our biodata bank, we don't think that matters for the reasons that we have described, but clearly, ensuring that we have a certain U.S. presence as it relates to engaging U.S. pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies, that of course will be critical. You know, Justin is in the U.S. and has, you know, of course over the years built up a presence, our name there, but this is definitely something we expect to expand also now with Michael coming in, to make sure that our U.S. presence from a commercial point of view is strong, so that our value proposition is understood and we can deliver, you know, against the expectations that our U.S. customers would have.
Yep, got it. And I know we've talked, you know, many times about how these pharma partnerships have more value than just the near-term revenue that they're generating. you know, particularly as you pursue more of these partnerships where you're participating more in the long-term potential upside, is there a way to think about how you view the risk-adjusted NPVs of the deals you have signed so far, or elaborate on those as you sign new partnerships going forward?
Yeah, so I think what you can commit to there, and I think we'll start that in the Q2 result publication, we will give you a better structured overview of the deals that we do and what category they fall. So you don't have just a number of deals we signed and you try to figure out, is this now a deal that was a $20,000 service for answering a question, or was this something that has a big future revenue potential? So I think we can provide you with these structures, and then over time we can, I think, educate you on how you would potentially value some of those deals. I mean, don't expect this to be in next quarter something where we're suddenly going to share with you a treasure trove of deals with huge value. That's not the intention, but we want to share with you how we think about those values, where the deal is today, and then every quarter when we actually communicate new deals, you know in which bucket to put them. I think that's what we're going to do going forward.
Yep, great. That would be super helpful. And then if I could squeeze one more in, is once you have the patient-derived cell-based models and or a full disease model, you know, what's really the next step there? And what's your preference between advancing with internal discovery work versus finding a partner to move forward in that disease state?
Yeah, so first I want to clarify maybe a terminology. I mean, on one side, we have a cell-based disease model. I think that was nicely described also by Phil. And I find it quite intriguing that we have, or we can build cell models from specific patients with different disease outcomes. And of course, those are also patients, you know, that are complementing our biodata bank. And that really allows us to validate some of the research that we do and the hypothesis that we look after in terms of why, as has been described also by Peter, certain patients have a different outcome. So that those are our cell derived disease models. When we talk about a full disease model for a priority disease, we are not just referring to those cell models, but referring to an omics data pool, if you wish, that really are set up and defined for us to pretty much, you know, answer the specific questions in terms of what could be a disease modifier, what could be a biomarker for disease progression. And we expect, it will of course vary a bit per disease, and of course the more narrow the question you ask, I mean, the smaller the data set could be, but we expect that we need about somewhere between 100 and 500 fully analyzed with full omics and, you know, with the cell model backed up, you know, data set to really do that work and do some of the work that Volkmar has described with our AI tools to really provide with those insights. And once we have that, how to translate that into a strategic partnership, I think there are different ways to that. A partnership always takes two, so I don't think we need to corner us into one way by which we do it. It is clear in our mind that we want to partner those models. We have no intention to become a biotech company that will translate these insights all the way into an approved drug ourselves. That's not the intention. When we partner, we'll also depend on what are the capabilities that the partner brings to the table to complement the work that we do. So if a partner has, for example, a therapeutic platform, is an RNA platform, is interested in using RNA for a disease that we have developed the model, and we exactly understand when to engage with them to ensure that the insights we generate allows for a rapid validation of an RNA solution against that disease, then we may partner earlier. In certain areas, like with Evotec, when we go after high throughput screening for small molecules and we feel, you know, this can be done without really having to sign a strategic partnership deal because the capabilities can be developed or done in-house, then we may go one step further. So case by case, I would say.
Got it. Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Alex Colgut from Kempen. Alex, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the presentation. Thank you for taking my questions. I don't have so many left, so I was just wondering if you could perhaps clarify a bit on the goal to sign two core strategic partnerships. Are these, do we correctly interpret that these are rather discovery development type deals than kind of, you know, helping partners to find the recruit trials?
So the, when we refer to a strategic partnership, our intention is to come up with a partnership where our insights and what we can bring into the partnership is valued such that we can, in that context, come up with a deal that allows us to participate in the value that is developed while the project moves from discovery into R&D. So we expect that we will see more of these deals if we have discovery partnerships, because obviously early in discovery, the tools that we have developed have the highest relative value. In clinical trial support, in that category that Michael has mentioned, if you're supporting a company like Alector, who already has a clear way by which they want to execute on a certain candidate in the clinic, and they want our help to accelerate or facilitate that clinical trial, we expect those to be more of the service deals. Michael, anything you wanted to add?
Hi, Alex, this is Michael. I'm happy to add to that. That's exactly what Andrian said. You know, obviously, you know, patient stratification, identification together with biomarker development, that's exactly, you know, our core competence in this area where we're leveraging with clinical trial support or even with identifying patients for on-market drugs. And then this this sort of drug discovery and development type collaboration is actually where we go a step further into target discovery, target validation, and then identify you know, a partner who has an interest in the same disease, in the same disease area, and then jointly in a more long-term R&D collaboration, we move forward programs, ultimately morphing into clinical candidates. And that's then where we would expect, obviously, a higher value contribution to the company.
Thank you, Michael. I mean, as you know, the Denali program is one which was by and large a clinical trial support program where we actually do have a milestone agreement with Denali. So it is possible that, and I think the stronger our support gets for the company, you know, you may see a certain value share there as well, but I think that will be the lower part of those deals compared to the discovery deals where we think value share should become the norm going forward.
Got it. No, that's very helpful. And just another question. You've compared yourself to some, you know, successful companies that have been able to generate high revenue growth from their databases. You know, what are kind of, are there any best practices that you're looking to implement at Centogene to further monetize the platform? You know, if you look at those comparable peers.
Yeah, well, I don't want to go into too much details. I think that, you know, probably too much for the call here. But I think when you look at those companies, they are largely U.S. companies. Keep that in mind. And I think in the U.S., there is clearly an attractive way by which you can generate revenues from genetic testing, also on the clinical side. I mean, much more, for example, than in Europe. So I think there is a revenue growth coming there that is the result of the US presence, not so much from the data insights for R&D and discovery that we talk about it, but simply from being able to reach out, test patients and turn that into revenues, which, for example, in Europe, yet alone in some of the emerging markets that we are here, of course, is less the case. Again, we do not think that this is any concern to our business in terms of how we can generate the long-term value, but that explains some of the short-term difference. I think best practice, Foundation Medicine, I think we find intriguing, to give you one example. I think there are learnings from each of these companies. We think Foundation Medicine is interesting for the fact that they have been very successful in translating an insight or a biomarker insight, if you wish, from a specific indication into highly attractive value proposition for a pharmaceutical company. So I think that is definitely something that we also want to do. Of course, we are not in oncology, we are rare diseases, but there are definitely some learnings that we want to apply to make sure that in rare disease, we can make more of this happen as well. And it doesn't need to be the same huge value deal as in oncology, but as we have shown with you, even in rare diseases, I mean, there are an increasing number of diseases who can absolutely reach blockbuster potential to the extent that the therapeutic approach makes progress. So I think the opportunity also from a value point of view is really there. Somebody said to me recently, Alex, so maybe we should say we are the foundation medicine of rare diseases. I wouldn't say that because rare diseases are different from oncology and not all learnings from foundation medicine apply to us. But a few insights, I think, clearly are intriguing to understand and leverage.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Erin Wright from Credit Suisse. Erin, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Great. Thank you. With the new management team and strategic vision here, does this incorporate a renewed go-to-market strategy when acquiring new pharma partnerships? Will you be building out more on that front in terms of the team and in the sales effort? And then in terms of that transparency and disclosure dynamic, and I think you alluded to this earlier, but you will be discussing more about the mix of revenue between one-time fixed fee or fee per sample or milestone revenue for the pharma relationships going forward. Will that be the case? Thanks.
Yeah, so I think on the first piece, yes, absolutely. I think that, as I tried to explain before, that's clearly why Michael joined, but not just Michael, I mean also Max. When I joined and when I looked a bit back, that was one of the simple key insights to build upon, which was that the company, while having a tremendous scientific drive, didn't really have a commercial infrastructure that deserved the name. And the way by which we think about commercialization in genetic diagnostics is very different. The customers are very different than the way by which we think about creating value in R&D and with whom we need to work to get that done. And this is a reason why we decided to have a chief commercial officer for diagnostic and a chief commercial officer for pharma who can really fully pursue with focus those very specific customers and business opportunities. And I think that's the right thing to do. And I have little doubt you will see that based on that, we're going to have an acceleration of our translating our strategy into value and revenues. The appointment, as you can expect from a great leader, which both of them are in these positions, is just a start. They will over the coming months, they will augment their teams to ensure that we have the horsepower that it requires to reach our customers. Now on the pharma side, don't expect this to be 100 people here that we need to hire. Of course not. It will be a relatively small team still focused on the right customers, but it will clearly be bigger than what we have today.
Okay, great. And then on the pharma initiative, just as that becomes a bigger part of kind of the business here, has anything changed? And I'm probably too early asking this, but has anything changed in terms of the long-term gross margin prospects, long-term EBITDA margin targets for the business? I mean, can you discuss kind of where you stand on that front or when we'll get some visibility on what the long-term goals are there and what initiatives you have in place to reach those goals? Thanks.
Yeah, give Rene a few months. I mean, that's one of the key tasks that he has. I mean, to come up with a more simplified and more transparency around a resource allocation model that explains to you how we think about where we put our resources and what type of valuations to expect and how this will play out as the business grows over the over the years. That said, we are not in a run here to make a profit. I mean, we do expect that over the coming years, we will further invest, and to the extent that we are further building out our tools, partner those tools with the right pharmaceutical partners, we do expect that this will require investments. And hence, we are not in here to try to push to make this company profitable in the next few years, but we want to make sure that we are thoughtful on investing the resources and keeping a foot in the door in those deals where we really feel that with the leverage that we have, we can then benefit from the upside that these programs have while they move ahead in discovery and development. I also think that we are in a fortunate position, however, that next to funding some of these investments with external capital, and I expect eventually we will have to do, or we will do, a next capital raise, I mean, to sustain that, that agenda, we do have a revenue stream that comes in. So in through our pharma service business and through our clinical diagnostic business that we expect to grow, we of course generate cash as well. So the capital that we will invest into growing the platform will take half, not exactly as 50%, but just in terms of the sources, will half come from the growth of our revenues from our existing businesses, and then to some extent come from the capital that we expect, well, some of it we already have, but then of course we expect to raise in the years to come. René, anything you wanted to add?
No, I can only support what you're saying. I mean, of course, we have to work on our, what do you call it, our internal operational model. I also believe this is really a team effort. This also involves, how should I put it, other departments, that the ones that are present here. But then together we can work on creating the transparency internally that is needed. And by doing that, then we can also, how should I put it, move the margin, push the margin forward, and then make sure that, how should I put it, we deploy our capital the best way possible. So, but it is probably a little bit too early for me to come up with a long report about this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That was our final telephone question, so I'll hand the call back over to Leonard.
Yes, thanks very much. I've been monitoring the chat as well. There's one question that hasn't been covered yet relating to HR resources. You touched on a little bit, Andrin, regarding building up the team. Do we have what it takes to onboard talented scientists in genomics and data analytics, given the headquarters is in Rostock? So I thought this is a good question maybe to still answer.
Yeah, so I think let's forget, we don't have only a presence in Rostock. I mean, we do have an office in Berlin. We have one in Boston. Phil? Right? I mean, you are in Boston right now. I mean, the screen looks similar in the back, given the virtuality, but we do have currently a presence in Boston. And we also have opened up an office in Switzerland. With regards of the future talent, the way that you mentioned it, it is our clear intention, to hire the best people that we need for our efforts going forward. We have started with, the management team present today, and we will complement, with the right scientists and the right experts that we need for our future success. Rostock will always stay, a critical, important pillar of our business. I mean, we have our lab operations here, high quality, very competent, led by Florian Vogel, our chief process officer. And I think it's a fantastic location to have and further grow that. But we are also exploring with regards of, where we may expand further talent, given the experts that we are trying to identify. So in that regard, the location will be defined by the talent and not the other way around.
Sounds good. And I think we're at the top of the hour, and I also don't show any further questions. So I would like to say thank you for joining us today. We hope the information presented was very helpful. And we look forward to meeting you at upcoming investor conferences. And as travel resumes, obviously doing that in person, management will be happy to meet you in person. And with that, have a wonderful day. And I'm handing back to Nadia. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes the Centogene Investor Day call. Thank you all for joining. You may now disconnect your lines.